for people to have a, you know, a working knowledge of principles of federal jurisdiction. Now let's deal with the let's move on and bring in we talked about treaties, and we're about due for a break right about now, aren't we,
yeah,
Peter?
Well, we are, but music
okay.
covered that.
So. Well, let's, I want to talk about, after the break, let's talk about gun laws, federal gun laws.
Okay, well, let me see if I can summarize this before we do hear the music then, Larry. Like the executive orders, the Social Security Act, at least the first one, and apparently the second one, too, because it wasn't in principle any different, are unconstitutional, but until someone challenges those, they're going to be on the books, and Congress is going to proceed, and Americans who are woefully ignorant of this knowledge are going to accept these as lawful authority, right?
That's true, and that's one of the reasons why I think it's so critically important. You got too many people out there, here's my tax program. You know, for $600 you can exit the tax program. Or, go exempt. I think that before you get a whole bunch of people in a certain direction, it's far better for us to come along and challenge it in court and prevail on these issues. I think we ought to prevail on these issues before we send a whole bunch of people into harm's way by telling them to do something.
Well, and is it your recommendation that we can go to court, on some civil matter? I mean, how do you get these?
Well, hey, Peter, you know something about the tax laws. You tell me, what was the first big case dealing with the income tax? And I'll give you a year. It started in 1894.
Okay, Pollock.
Yeah. Pollock against who? Farmers? Loan and trust? Mm-hmm. Now, was the United States a party to that case? I don't see where they were. You had Pollock, the plaintiff, and he sued Farmers, Loan and Trust.
Uh-huh.
And the United States wasn't a party, was he? Was it?
No.
Okay, well, now let's move forward. Let's go to 1913. We get the alleged 16th Amendment in place, and by October 1913, Congress has passed the first income tax under the 16th Amendment.
Right.
And wasn't there some litigation shortly after that?
Bruce Shaver versus Union Pacific Railroad?
Really? Was Bruce Shaver, is that the United States?
Okay, so I see your point. So what we need to do is...
And Union Pacific, is that the United States?
No.
Ah, so here we have perfect illustrations of how a critically important litigation was started and the United States wasn't a party.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's wrong with, here you got, is that our message? Okay.
I haven't heard it.
Okay. Let's we had some large group in the tax movement a couple of years ago. We're going to go exempt.
Mm-hmm.
And you got a whole bunch of people that filed, this is a good idea. Not that there was a substantive legal argument directed toward withholding and that was being advocated at the time. But this has been a perpetual problem with the tax movement. That for years and years and years, you've had a whole bunch of people go out and say, let's do this, let's do that, and so you get a whole whole flock of people going in a certain direction, and they're all doing the same thing, and I mean, no offense by making the statement, but most people don't know what they're doing. Most people are acting on an emotional level rather than an intellectual level. This sounds good to me, and so they go out and do it. Well, why wasn't there a good attack made on withholding? Doesn't it make far better sense for there to be a legal challenge brought on withholding based on a substantive legal argument and go out and prevail on that? Why does, I talk to people all the time, trying to get people, let's do something about withholding. And, the first thing they want to do, I want to sue General Motors.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That doesn't make sense.
Right. Well, let's talk about that as soon as we come back, then, how to mount a successful legal argument. Stay with us, folks. Attorney Larry Beecraft and I are discussing federal jurisdiction and the many implications thereof. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Preparing ahead for the events in the future. In the near future, we know there will be those of us that will not be able to buy or sell. Stoves and More wants to help give you the freedom from the systems of the world and from the skyrocketing fuel prices. Stoves and More is a dealer for all Amish-built wood cook stoves that will give you an independence you need to cook and bake your food, dry fruits and vegetables, heat your whole house water system, and heat your home. These state-of-the-art cook stoves are nothing like grandma's old stoves. They have large, airtight, efficient fireboxes that give you an all-night burn, easily heating up to 2,000 square feet. Whether or not you're off the grid, we have products for you from stoves to Staber washers and 12 and 24 volt refrigeration. At Stoves and More, we have the perfect products to complete your preparations. To the first 10 people who purchase a stove, we'll send a free copy of our newly released DVD, Getting Started with Wood Cook Stoves. Stoves and More offers the best selection at the lowest prices on the web, so visit us at www.stovesandmoreonline.com. Website again, stovesandmoreonline.com.
In Matthew 24, the disciples asked Jesus, "What shall be the signs of thy coming and the end of the world?" Jesus answered them, "You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines, diseases, earthquakes in many places. Fellow Americans, we are living in this time of Earth's history. People everywhere are trying to understand these climatic world events in light of human wisdom, but without the wisdom of God, this is impossible. Our ministry would like to offer information on the Mark of the Beast and the Unholy Alliance. It includes four books and several DVDs for your information. It discusses America in prophecy, the Antichrist, tyrants and wars, secret societies, the New World Order, and much more. So to be prepared for what is coming on the world as an overwhelming surprise, call for your free materials, Packet F. 888-211-1715. Again, 888-211-1715.
Hi, Steve Shank, Fearless Task Force. Sure, you've got a mortgage and credit cards. Your debt creation is probably the smartest thing you've ever done. How would it be to find $75,000, $150,000, $200,000 or more you never knew you had? Now the task force has strategies to make these debts into virtual savings accounts. Ben Franklin said, "A penny saved is a penny earned." By doing nothing more than you're doing right now, because you've used your credit, the right strategies can make the debt part of your financial life the smartest thing you've ever done. Oh, by the way, your strategies cost you nothing out of pocket. Go ahead and check out the debt elimination scams if you'd like to. You wouldn't take money from a loan shark, so you may not want to give your money to a debt shark. For an understanding of what a financial genius you truly are, call 800-409-5633. On the web, mydebtfreepath.com. 800-409-5633.
Ladies and gentlemen, to the Peter Mac Show. My special guest today with me is attorney Larry Beecraft, and we're discussing federal jurisdiction, and the implications of this are just profound, as I had sensed before doing the show with Larry, but I'm just being enlightened with every few minutes that we discuss this. Okay, so Larry, my sense is, from what you told me then, is the way to challenge the constitutional or legality of various acts of Congress that are clearly unconstitutional to people like you and me that read the Constitution and understand its limits is not to take on the federal government directly, but to take on a private third party. So you have a case like Bruce Shaber versus Union Pacific or Pollock versus farmers and so forth, so that the federal government is in effect placed in the position of being the neutral third party.
The history is full of that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of test cases. You go back into the 1796, and you had the Hilton case. I've read a whole bunch of material. Vern Holland's book, which incidentally I keep plugging John Rowland's website, constitution.org. It's Vern Holland's book is posted over there on John's website. But, you can read Vern's book. And, Vern did a real detailed study of the Hilton case back in 1796. And, the case was a setup. Mm-hmm. And, I've tried for years to tell the Patriot Movement, for example, when the money issue was kind of hot back in the early 80s, there was a St. Louis cab driver that was an advocate of, he was a burglar too. His name was Amos Bruce. But, you know, Amos was quite a character, and he was in the money issue camp. And, you know, he was very knowledgeable about all this. But, you know, I made a suggestion to Amos one time. I said, look, you know, here's a good way to, for us to tangle with the money issue. You know, have the two of us get involved in litigation seeking a declaratory judgment as to what is a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, don't you think that in, you know, in a test case with, you know, such parties, you can get an honest assessment of the issue more so than anything else? Why don't people in the tax movement want we raise litigation? You know, I don't suggest we go out and raise, you know, just have a whole bunch of people suing each other. But, you know, that's certainly a way to get it done. You know, in response to the reason I made the suggestion to Amos that we sue each other over the money issue, you know, you enter into a contract, pay so much dollars. Well, what's the dollar? You know, that's you can file a declaratory judgment over that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can prepare your briefs in advance before you file your lawsuit. But, you know, instead, you know, we had what rolled out of advocacy of the money issue back in those days was, you know, you have the people that really want to do stuff are the ones that have got their tail in a crack. You know, like there is one of these adverse money issue cases, you know, where the money issue, you know, the guy was complaining about, well, gee, you know, I don't want to pay my child support. I can't pay child support because there's no gold and silver coin.
Right.
Now, that's a real good fact situation for bringing up the money issue, don't you think? I mean, you know,
absolutely.
Just a fact situation that is enough to piss off a judge. And,
right.
You know, there's a lot of litigants in this movement that, you know, the first thing that they want to do is they want to piss off the judge before they want. You know, a judge, you know, it should be somebody that you should be approached in a friendly manner. And
mm-hmm.
you're an advocate in front of him, and what you're trying to do is persuade him over to your side. Well, you don't walk in the first thing out of the bat and just start calling them names.
Well,
I mean, that seems to be the litigation approach of too many people in the movement.
Well, let me ask you this then. One of the things you suggested, and you did to me before the show, was that somebody mount a case on the withholding issue to say to their employer. And I think you said a few minutes ago before the break, you know, not to obviously take on somebody of the size of General Motors, but you know.
Well, I mean, this is just general talk here about litigation strategy.
I understand
I think most people know the organization that I'm talking about. You know, they went out and said, "Oh, stop withholding." Well, you know, that's just an example.
Right.
What if it was litigated first, and we had a favorable decision? Then, once you have it litigated and won on the issue, then you can have people doing it. That's the point that I'm making.
I understand, but let me just pose this question then. If somebody were to mount a lawsuit against their employer on the withholding issue, is it not the case that the judge, even though he's a third party and if he's, you know, handled with kid gloves as you're suggesting, is it not the case that he's going to see the ramifications for?
Well, you know, to let me address that issue. That's the reason why I would suggest, you know, that if some of these test cases, the people that are interested in the tax issues, you know, if they want to do something, you know, I'll give you an example here in a minute. But, you know, I think, you know, we got a number of states that don't have state income taxes.
Right.
And so if you mount litigation, friendly test cases in those states in state court involving federal questions in state court over, you know, a lot of these important issues, don't you think you'll have a far better chance of prevailing by doing it where the judge is part of a government that doesn't have a dog in the fight?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to get, you know, if you brought a tax challenge to the federal income tax in Texas state court, don't you think you're going to get a lot better reception and a judge is going to listen a lot more so than in federal court?
Sure.
Against the government?
Right.
Yeah, but that seems to be, you know, what everybody wants to do. But, you know, this is what the legal community advocates, but, you know, it's not what the freedom movement advocates.
Right.
But hey, Peter, let's, you know, since we're on jurisdiction, then I don't want to forget. We only got about 45 minutes left. I wanted to talk about some about tax, but
right.
There's this topic about guns.
Okay.
Okay. Now let me test your constitutional knowledge. Is the United States Constitution silent on the matter of guns?
No, the Second Amendment gives the right to keep and bear arms.
It does?
Yep.
Let me clarify that.
Okay, before I speak to an attorney on that issue, it says no. If you'll give me a flip.
A militia being necessary to a free state.
Right. I just wanted to read it verbatim rather than.
We don't need to. Look, who's the object right. of that sentence is? Is it not the people of the United States?
Right, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
The people. All right. Now, you have a wealth of authority out there on the point that aliens are not a part of the people. Would you agree?
Okay.
All right. Now, if you come along and let's ignore for the present moment, you know, the jurisdictional implications of the 1934 Gun Act.
Okay.
But let's ignore for that moment. Couldn't Congress, without offending the Second Amendment, come out with all sorts of stringent controls on commerce and possession of guns by aliens?
Sure.
And that wouldn't offend the Second Amendment at all, would it?
Right.
Because aliens are not a part of the people.
Right.
Okay. Now let's take a. Consider a similar topic, you know, a different topic, but it's similar in import, okay?
Okay.
Now, Article 1, Section 10 of the United States Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1, says no state shall make anything other than gold, silver, coin, tender, and payment of debts, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, that only applies to the states, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, within the jurisdiction of the United States, Washington D.C. and the territories and its possessions, does Article 1, Section 10 have any application?
Not that I can see.
Right. Okay. Now, let's go back to the gun laws.
Okay.
And but also in the kind of draw some parallels to the money issue.
Okay.
This is going to be kind of a treaty-based argument. The first time you see real efforts at the federal level to do something about guns is back in the 1890s, when Congress came along and passed some legislation that controlled the traffic in arms and war materiel to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And the president was given the authority to interdict that traffic. You know, it could be the legislation could be, quote, implemented by his proclamations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the statutory authority. So, you know, once you take a look at, that know about that legislation, then you start taking a look at the proclamations of the president. The money issue, in my view, becomes crystal clear. Let's go back to the time that Ulysses S. Grant was in office. This would be about 1870, 1871.
Mm-hmm.
And he would periodically issue some proclamations regarding disturbances and regarding possessions of guns that, plays a role in the proper construction of the federal gun laws. One of the first things that Ulysses S. Grant did, in one of these proclamations, that I'd have to go look at it specifically. I'm talking in general terms here. Let's say that there was some problem in Arkansas or Colorado or something like that. He would issue these proclamations and he would say, I hereby implore every citizen of the United States and every person. So, Peter, in that context, the President of the United States means by the word person what?
Well, obviously it implies something different than citizen.
Yeah. Well, what's the opposite? The opposite of a citizen is a non-citizen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a non-citizen is, what do we call him?
An alien?
Yeah.
Okay.
We also call him a resident.
Okay.
If you pull up the code, and I hope we get around to that here in a minute, if you pull up the code, doesn't the United States Code, Title 26, and doesn't the corresponding tax regulations, don't they use that phrase citizen or resident over and over and over again? I don't know how many times they use it, but
sure.
Isn't that a constant phrase?
Sure.
So in that context, what is a resident, Peter?
Well, obviously something other than a citizen.
Yeah, so...
That's a resident alien, for example, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So a resident's an alien.
Somebody who's residing here, but from another country.
Right. And I might also admit, throw in, but where this is probably a digression, you know, residence and domicile are two different things, too. Although closely related, they are the, you know, they are mutually exclusive. But, you know, a resident's an alien. And in this context, we're talking about a reference to the gun laws, you know, citizen or person, you know, person means a blooming alien, right?
Okay.
And you just admitted to me a moment ago that the Second Amendment would not protect an alien or his possession of guns.
Right.
Right? So now, here you have, you know, the Ulysses S. Grant. From that point forward, you know, if you have access to the United States statutes at large, go over there to the proclamations, like I've done. And, you know, look at a lot of these things, and you frequently see over and over and over again, you know, the President of the United States, in reference to these gun proclamations, using this little phrase, I hereby implore every citizen of the United States and every person. In that context, person means an alien. And when the law to interdict the traffic in war material and arms to African states was adopted in the mid-1890s, the proclamations of the president came out and continued what Ulysses S. Grant had to say. Well, then after World War One, you know, and the creation of the League of Nations, you know, the League of Nations was very interested in, you know, banishing. You know, I think if we had lived at that time and we lived in Europe after World War One, we would be thoroughly disgusted with war. And we would want to banish war. And there was a legitimate effort to banish war, and that was a high priority with the League of Nations.
Right.
But, you know, even the League of Nations, when it would come out with the various proposals, you know, the United States, you know, we had to, you know, hey, we can't just sit there, even though we weren't a member of the League of Nations, we couldn't sit there and, you know, just, you know, slap them around. You know, we were the biggest arms manufacturer in the world at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And but in any event, you know, when the President of the United States would issue one of these proclamations to interdict the flow of arms and war material into Chile or Brazil or Spain or Chacao, wherever Chacao is, you know, the President would come out and issue these proclamations. I hereby implore every citizen of the United States and every person. So the President of the United States, the chief law enforcement officer, was sitting there and saying, hey, when I saw, you know, when I issue these gun proclamations, person means an alien. Well,
but he's also issuing them about citizens, right?
Yeah, but in reference to international activities.
Ah, okay.
Okay. Alien. I mean, yeah, hey, look, man, you know, if we got, you know, civil war going on down in Nicaragua, you know, you know, I'm in Beaumont, Texas, or Houston, Texas, or Galveston, Texas, and I'm getting ready to ship a load of arms to some warring party down in Nicaragua, you know, you don't think Uncle Sam's going to take an interest in that since he's been delegated the exclusive power to engage in relations with the rest of the world?
Sure.
You don't think that I'm interfering with that?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Well, so Uncle Sam exercises jurisdiction over, you know, me, if I were an arms smuggler, so getting ready to ship a shipment of guns to Nicaragua, you know, Uncle Sam doesn't take lightly to that. You know, if you're not a political favorite, let me say that.
Okay.
You know, you could be, you know, Ollie North and,
right,
and, you know, things look the other way.
Okay.
But let's come up to 1934. In 1934, June of 1934, Congress came along and passed the 1934 Gun Act. All right, now let's put into context what old FDR was doing right before that. You know, FDR made several proclamations pursuant to his power, to statutory power to interdict the flow of arms and war material. He exercised his power pursuant to those acts. He did, you know, the presidents did it in the 20s, and he was doing it in the 30s. Now, he did several, you know, in 33 and 34. But I'm going to direct your attention to a couple of days before the federal gun law in 1934 was adopted by Congress. Let's say it's May 28th, 1934. Guess what? On that date, FDR comes out with a gun proclamation and says, I hereby interdict the traffic in arms and war materiel to whatever spot on the face of the earth, Spain or wherever, and I hereby implore every citizen of the United States and every person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so person in that context means what, Peter?
Alien.
Ah, okay. All right, now, let's go to, let's say, you know, I don't have it off the top of my head, let's say that June the 4th of 1934 is when the Gun Act goes into effect. Incidentally, at the same time, you know, there was a confab over in Switzerland. You know, the League of Nations was meeting over there, and it was a convention to, you know, ban war.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Uncle Sam's got to do some favors, so, you know, Uncle Sam passes some laws. You know, we're gonna do something about guns, you know, even though we make a spy of the rest of the world with guns. But in any event, shortly after that, you know, a day or two after that, FDR comes out with another proclamation interdicting to Yugoslavia or wherever the trafficking of war arms and war materiel by every citizen of the United States and every person. And in that context, Peter, what does person mean?
Again, I guess a non-citizen.
Okay, so here you have, right before and a couple of days after, the 1934 Gun Act comes into effect. You got the President of the United States, Chief Law Enforcement Officer, coming out and saying, hey, when I say the word person, I mean he's an alien. Now let's look at the gun law. You know, it's not but about 7 or 8 pages, that 1934 Act. It's kind of short.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first thing I ask is, you know, gee, where in there do you find some clear expression of legislative intent that it applies within the jurisdiction of states? You don't find it. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. Well, you know, we have been talking about jurisdiction, so I'll make that comment.
Mm-hmm.
But on the major point, you know, when you read through the Act, you know, it's directed toward the typical lawful subject of legislation, Mr. Person.
Right.
So if the Second Amendment protects the people, if the people are citizens, and the President of the United States has been using the word person in the context of an alien, well, then if casting that meaning onto the word person in the 1934 Act, if person there means alien, has the Second Amendment been violated?
Not at that point.
Okay.
So let me summarize it as I understand it and refine or correct it as you will, Larry. The government comes along in the, at least with respect to the gun laws, and says, okay, we have jurisdiction over the selling of guns to other countries because obviously the federal government has jurisdiction over treaties and relations with
international
commerce. Okay. So they come along and they carefully craft legislation that includes both citizens and non-citizens, or in this context, residents, if they are trafficking in, and I don't use that word in a necessarily in an illegal way, but trafficking in guns that are going overseas. Then they come along and pass legislation which appears to be be imposed upon citizens of this country, but they carefully fail to use the word citizens. And in my view, obviously, knowing that the American people, the average citizen, is going to read that and assume that that applies to him, when in fact it is confined to the limits of the jurisdiction of the United States.
Yeah, and for our discussion, it's real important here to, you know, the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, if you sit down and you analyze, you know, just do like I've done. Go through the entire United States statutes at large and isolate all these laws. And, you know, I've got about 300 or 400 of, you know, pages from the statutes at large, you know, where, you know, I find, you know, like, you know, somewhere around about 1898 or 1899, you know, we had entered into a treaty with Great Britain to regulate the hunting of fur seals.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And, you know, in that particular law, you know, Congress comes out and, you know, applies it to, you know, hunting in the Arctic and, you know, wherever fur seals are. You know, they impose this law on citizens and persons.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so what's persons in that context, Peter?
Again, non-citizens.
Yeah. And, you know, so what, you know, let me just kind of condense, if I can, you know, the point that I'm making. you know, from a study, and that's the reason why I'm saying, you know, I'd like for people to kind of, you know, first, if you're interested in a topic, study it. Mm-hmm. You can read, you know, if you read one case per year, you can read 52 in 1 year.
One case per week, right?
Yeah, one case per week.
You said one case per year. I was just
correcting. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, okay, yeah. My mistake.
Right.
I'm glad you're there catching me.
Okay. That's why I had dialogue with you. Yeah. Okay.
If you just read one case per week, what's so difficult about what would be so difficult about doing two cases per week?
Right.
You know, read one during the week and one during the weekend.
Right. Here's,
you know,
the
people would increase their knowledge.
Yeah. Here's my point on that, though, Larry. The non-attorney like myself has to have some direction. The law is this huge convoluted mass. If I'm teaching mathematics to people, as I do, I have to provide direction. I can't sit there and say, here's a book on calculus, study it.
I agree. But, you know, this is conditioned upon, there's a lot of good, solid information on the Internet. Like, for example, one of the topics we want to talk about today, which we're apparently not going to get to, the money issue. You know, people can go over to my website and just read my money issue brief, and you can sit there in front of your computer and just click on that link that carries you over to, you know, one of the Supreme Court cases on the money issue and read it. And that's what I mean, you know, or on the topic of jurisdiction. You know, I've got on the point of jurisdiction, you got on not only the brief that, you know, mentions about 150 cases in it, but then, you know, I've got three different files beyond that. You know, I've got all the Supreme Court cases with links to the cases. I've got a short summary of the case, and then boom, you can read it. Click on it. You can sit there on your computer, and we could have people that could master, you know, topics. And then, you know, just if you're out in the ordinary conversation, you know, you're standing in line at the Quick Stop or the grocery line, you know, and somebody ahead of you says, "Well, gee, don't you fear that executive proclamation?" You can say, "Well, have you considered thus and such?"
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what we need in this movement is people that are grounded on something legally substantive rather than grounded upon rumor and hearsay. And there's just too much of that rumor and hearsay. But I digress. Let's get back to, you know, this point about persons. You know, what I have found, you know, like on national and like on person, you know, there's a lot of instances. You can go through the statutes at large. You can get on the Internet, pull up codes, and see how these words are used. And, you know, I will tell you this, having studied the word individual goes back into, you know, the 1790s, they were using that word. But remarkably, individual, seldom defined.
Right.
Okay? But you will find too many frequent examples of the term citizen or person. And in that context, person's different from citizen. And I maintain that, you know, since you've got all this prior legislative use of distinguishing and creating mutually exclusive categories, citizens, persons, they're not alike, then if you're going to encompass a citizen within any legislative scheme, within any body of legislation, you better include the citizen in the definition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's a principle of law that I've developed just by studying all 120 volumes of the statutes at large. But, hey, Peter, listen. You know, we've got, here's now the bottom of the hour. Can we drift over to tax?
Let's do that. In fact, Larry, let me bring up, since you brought up the term citizen, you know, Congress puts out this, from time to time, the CRS report for Congress, and I'm looking at one now called Frequently Asked Questions Concerning the Federal Income Tax, and the one I happen to be looking at is updated May 7th, 2001, so there may well be one more recent. But you know, in the context of Larkin Rose's trial and so forth, it was centered around the 861 evidence and stuff. And question 21 says, do the IRC, Internal Revenue Code, source of income rules exempt the income of U.S. citizens? And the answer by this fellow, John R. Lucky, is no. The answer to the question is no. The question is based on the claim that the sources of income rules of the IRC only apply to non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. So my question, I guess, to lead off into discussion about tax is, within the statutes about the federal income tax, do they make it explicitly clear whom those apply to? And is the word citizen used in this question and in this answer, is that used in the same way that we're using the word citizen here. Does that?
Well, I think there's a lot of people that's out there on, you know, there may very well be, although the evidence of such is very well hidden, there may very well be a difference between a citizen of the United States of America, which is what I would consider myself.
Right.
You know, I'm an American citizen.
Sure.
You know, but I like to use that phrase, I'm an American citizen. I don't claim to be a national. I don't claim to be, right, you know, unless there's a form in front of me, a U.S. citizen. There may very well be a distinction between U.S. citizen and a citizen of the United States of America. But the proof on that point is not existent. What I do find is that, America may well, very well be the freest country in the world, because I find precious little in the way of legislation, state and federal, that does actually encompass a citizen. You know, too often the lawful subjects of legislation. Let me make a point about that. When okay. Congress would create the territories, you know, mm-hmm. let's say like it's creating the territory of, you know, Missouri or Illinois or Arkansas or, you know, California.
Mm-hmm.
When they would create those, they would create a legislature for the territory, and Congress would sit there and say, and the power of the legislature extends to lawful subjects of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, that's a real good, hey, it's a legal term. I didn't make it up. It's one Congress uses. And, you know, I think that's a term that the movement ought to use. You know, what is a lawful subject of legislation? And, you know, that was a term that Congress used to describe the legislative power of a territorial legislature. And, you know, it seems very apropos today. You know, what's the who are lawful subjects of legislation for the California, the Georgia, the New York, the Alabama, the Texas legislature? You know, what
sure.
are those lawful subjects of legislation? And I'd like to see people kind of start speaking in those terms, because it might have a unifying effect for everybody that's interested in these types of issues.
Right.
But let's get back to, you know, let's get back to tax. You know, here we've got a limited amount of time. To understand something about tax, you know, what I find, and this is a constant criticism I make of, I'll just say everybody. And when I say everybody, I'm saying people in the tax movement and tax professionals as well.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to sit there and use the current code. Everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the world.
When you say the current code, let's just clarify, people. You
1986 code or the 1954 code?
You're talking about
Title 26.
Title 26. Okay.
And, you know,
otherwise known as the Internal Revenue Code.
Absolutely. And, you know, you got Irwin Schiff would come along. You know, hey, you know, he might, you know, and I think it's real important for everybody to have a real good command of the constitutional foundations for the federal income tax. That's real important. You know, mm-hmm. so people should study that. I've got files on my website you can study on that point. What
sure.
is the constitutional foundation? But there's a lot of good works out there on that point. But, you know, when you descend to, you know, talking about tax law, everybody deals with the current stuff. And, you know, there are two people that I know of. There's an entity and myself that say, no, that's wrong. And those two parties are the Supreme Court of the United States and a lot of courts and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, no, don't look at just the current code. And the reason I say that is because over and over and over and over again, the Supreme Court of the United States has said, when you're looking at the tax laws are construed in pari materia with each other. Now that means, in pari materia, you got to consider all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason why, you know, Peter, I've given you a disc, and I've also given it to Larkin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's just one disc that I put together. You know, I saw back in, you know, the late 90s and, you know, the early part of this century, you know, I saw people beginning to get off into, you know, hey, the old regulations. So one of the things that I did is, you know, I've been using the old regulations for 20 years or better.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I copied them. You know, I've got whole books back there in my, you know, I've got the original published volumes of a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, about 2001, 2002, whenever it was, you know, I sat out and I made new, fresh copies so they could be scanned. Of all the old tax regulations, you know, regulations 33 and regulations 45 and many regulations 45 and 62, 65, 84, you know, 101 and 103, you know, the regs for the 1938 Act and 39 Code. You know, I make copies of those, and we scanned them, and they're word searchable now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I also sat down years ago, and I converted to text, and to make it look like the original printed version from the statutes at large, I converted all the tax acts. So now everybody can have, you know, because I put it together, all of the tax acts and all of the regulations. And you can cram all that stuff, certainly on two discs, and a lot of it can be stuck on one disc, one CD. And, you know, you got that CD, and I'd like for you to, you know, say for friends, neighbors, and listeners of this program, make that CD available.
Sure. I do.
But, you know, one of the things that I find that people, you know, and over and over and over again violate is they don't consider anything but the current code, which is wrong. And the reason I say it's wrong is you ask your tax professional, you ask him a sophisticated tax question, and he says, oh, you're nuts. Look at Section 1 of the code. There's hereby imposed on the taxable income of every individual. And, you know, but, hey, that's it. And that's the way the judges look at it. That's the way the tax professional, everybody.
Sure.
My friends from law school. Of course, when you go to law school, the thing that you learn after you get out of tax class is, you know, when you exit the second semester exam on tax, every law student said, you won't find me doing any of that. Absolutely.
What is it that they won't find themselves doing?
Tax law.
Oh,
tax law is going to be confined to the pointy-headed, you know, guys that want to go to NYU tax school.
Okay.
But most lawyers, and there's Supreme Court, there's cases on the point. Most lawyers don't know anything about tax. They don't.
Right.
You know, they're doing something else. They're doing what the American people want to do.
Sure.
Foreign corporations sue each other, you know, do contracts, you know, engage in business.
Right.
You know, there's not enough interest on constitutional questions. There's not enough interest in the population for tax questions. But be that as it may, I consider it critically important for everybody to comprehend that, you know, you can't just stop at the current code, which, incidentally, you can go over to constitution.org and download a PDF searchable version of the January 2002 Internal Revenue Code. And the reason I like PDF is because, you know, Adobe 7 has this good search feature. You hit search, insert your search term, and over on the right column, you know, every place that word appears in that document, boom, you can click on it, move to it. Mm-hmm. It's far better than the old PDF where you just move from one to the next and couldn't see what all the words were. Mm-hmm. You know, but all your search places show up in a box over on the right-hand side, and that's why, the reason why PDF word searches is so good, and that's the reason why I'd suggest people download the, you know, that 2002 version of the IRC. And incidentally, you can go over to whatistax.com and download all the regs and everything else. You may have already told your people about that.
Sure.
But, you know, one of the things that's real important is that, bearing in mind that the Supreme Court of the United States and Larry Becraft say, you got to consider all of it. That is the absolute truth. Now, having said that, let's put it into context. In 1954, well, the 1986 code is the one that we're dealing with. However, you know what the 1986 code is? If you go back and take a look at that act in 1986, all it did is it changed the name 54 code to 86 code. That's all it is. So the 86 code is really the 54 code.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the 54 code is, you know, if you read the committee reports, all it was is the 1939 code as it existed in, you know, August of 1954. Imagine somebody taking that code, sitting down and cutting up, you know, the all those sections of the code and even subsections of the code, cutting it up, you know, with a pair of scissors. And then once you got it all cut up, you kind of shuffle it.
Okay.
And, maybe kind of make it a new kind of a pattern, if you will. But all the 54 code is a reshuffling of the provisions of the 39 code. Well, you know, virtually all of them. There's a couple sections that are left out.
Right.
So the 54 code is really the 39 code.
Okay.
Well, what is the 39 code? The 39 code was the first codification. Now, I know there's a lot of patriot talk about what is the 39 code, but it was simply a codification. You know, starting in the 30s, everybody if you wanted to know something about federal tax laws, you'd have to really consult, you know, a wide variety of different acts.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why the 39 Code was adopted was to repeal, take out of all the various places in the United States statutes large, wherever there were currently, you know, current acts of Congress dealing with tax, well, all they did is they stuck them, they piled them all together and stuck them in the 39 Code. And that's what the 39 Code is. It's just simply the codification of the then existing tax laws. You know, you had the 35 Social Security Act became, you know, Section 1601 and following of the, and then Internal Revenue Code. Sections 11 through, you know, some 200, that was the income tax, and it was pulled straight from the 1938 Act. The 38 Act was the current act then in effect, so it went straight into the 39 Code.
Okay.
However, there's a problem. When you sit down and take a look at the 38 Act, you know, use your finger, you know, which section went where. In 1938, you had a provision, a Section 63, that said the 38 Act was in lieu of the 36 tax. That was Section 63 of the 1938 Act, and it did not go into the 1939 Code. When you take a look at Section 63 of the 39 Code, there's something different there. It isn't there. So this Section 63 from the 1938 Act didn't make it into the 1939 Code. All right, now let me stop right there. Now let's go back to 1916. Or let's go back to 1913.
Okay.
Well, let's go back to 1894. In 1894, Congress came along and the tax imposed section of the 1894 Act had as the subjects of it four classes of people: citizens at home,
mm-hmm.
citizens abroad, persons residing in the United States, and persons not residing in the United States. Those were the four classes of people that were the subject of the 1894 Act. Now, Peter, having said that, who is a person in that context in the 1894 Act?
Again, an alien.
Okay, all right, good. Now, we get the 16th Amendment, allegedly, and in October 1913, the 1913 Act comes out. And what they did is they copied the tax imposed section from the 1894 Act. And in reference to natural individuals, the 1913 Act imposed a tax on these four classes of natural people: citizens at home, citizens abroad, persons residing in the United States, and persons not residing in the United States. So, Peter, who's a person?
Well, again, an alien, right?
Yeah, a non-citizen. All right.
Non-citizen.
Now, after the Bruce-Shaber case came out, you know, a lot of what Congress did at that time, you know, if you look around and investigate, you know, say the boat tax. There was a boat tax that went to the Supreme Court back in about 1911, Billings against the United States. But I think it was about 1909 Congress imposed a tax on boats, you know, really yachts. I call it boats.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a direct parallel to the income tax. You know, they first came out and imposed the tax on boats, and it was foreign-built yachts.
Hmm.
Okay? And, of course, that went to the Supreme Court. Justice White, who wrote the opinion in the Bruce-Shaber case, Justice White said in the Billings case, you know, there's a difference between, and it's inherent in the Constitution, there's a difference between things domestic and things foreign and their use.
Hmm.
Isn't that very profound?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's what White said in the Billings case. You know, but they justified the tax on foreign-built yachts as being constitutional. Now, mm-hmm. what the boat tax does is it illustrates for you in microcosm what Congress has done with the income tax. You know, they first imposed the tax, and then the next tax that comes along, you know, a couple of years later, they say, well, in lieu of the previous tax, there's hereby imposed this tax.
Mm-hmm.
And you know they might, as time goes by, just simply delete the word foreign from it. However, if you look at the corresponding regulations will come along and, you know, they'll describe it as foreign. But you can see after you do this in lieu of, you know, every couple of years impose a lieu of tax, you can bury and make more uncertain who's subject to the tax.
Is that deliberate?
Well, what do you think, Peter?
I think so.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't disagree with you. Yeah. But that's what was done with the boat tax. Now, okay, let's talk about regulations. And this is on my website. If you want to study it in more detail, go to my website and do a word search on miscellaneous. And I've got down at the very, at the end of my little tax column, I kept it real small. It's the smallest font I could put on my website. It's called miscellaneous over kind of on the left side of the page. Click on that. Yeah, it was my attempt to hide things. But click on that, and you can go over and, there's a I've got stuff over there on the boat tax and the tax on telecommunications. Now, today, Peter, we got this tax on communications, telecommunications, but it started off as a tax on communications from onshore, offshore.
Mm-hmm.
And when you sit down and read this very short act, it didn't really, how does this exactly operate? Well, once you take a look at the Act and then take a look at the first regulation, which is also posted in this little file that I just described for you on the website, the regulation clarified how the tax operated. And the only example for the telecommunications tax appearing in the regulations was a tax imposed upon communications offshore to onshore, or onshore to offshore.
Hmm.
Now, isn't that important?
Mm-hmm.
And can you see how today, you could take that same basic scheme and, make it almost invisible? People, you pile a lot of jargon on top of that, and that scheme mm-hmm. could be, greatly concealed, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right. Now, let's take a look at, the 1913 Act, as a result of the Bruce-Shavers decision, got repealed.
Right. Larry, let me just interject. We have less than 10 minutes. I'd love for you to come back next week if we don't finish, but
okay.
I don't want to put you on the spot, so you can make that decision after.
We can. Yeah, I'll be.
Okay. That'd be right. Great. Okay, go ahead.
So in 1916, Congress comes along and scratches the 1913 Act, and this is a big problem in the movement because, you got people like Irwin Schiff coming along, look at the 1913 Act, or some critic, you had probably, as an advocate of 861, had these people, aha, look at the 1913 Act.
Right.
Scheme's not in effect.
Right.
Yeah, 1913 was repealed.
By the 1916 Act, you mean?
The 1913 Act was repealed by the 1916 Act.
Okay.
Section 24, bottom of the page, Section 24 repealed the 1913 Act.
Okay.
Now, the 1916 Act comes along, and it no longer said citizens at home and abroad. It now imposed upon individuals,
mm-hmm.
citizens or residents. Okay, and then in 1917, that act was amended and increased the, by this time, we had this income tax in place, and, the income tax is kind of like the government's hypodermic needle stuck in the American public. Suck off that blood, right? Isn't that a good, like a vulture or a vampire? That's
sure.
Not good. Okay, suck that blood,
right?
And now they got the rights to suck your blood,
right?
So the 1917 Act increased it, and starting in 1918, you have this in lieu of feature pops up. There is hereby imposed. In lieu of the tax imposed by the 1916 Act and the 1917 Act, this tax.
Uh-huh.
And so in 1921, Congress comes along and says, there is hereby imposed, in lieu of the 1918 tax, this tax.
Mm-hmm.
In 1924, there is hereby imposed, in lieu of the 1921 tax, this tax. In 1926, there is hereby imposed, in lieu of the 1924 tax, this tax.
Mm-hmm.
In 1928, you get the format for the 39 Code. And so you got your sections 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then starting in section 11, there is hereby imposed. But 1928, you have there is hereby imposed. And in lieu of was carved out. And whereas previously the tax imposed said in lieu of, starting in 1928, the in lieu of feature in that section vanished, and they stuck it over in section 63. And so you start in 1928, there is hereby imposed on the income of every individual, blah, 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 this tax. But You got to go over to Section 63. And, well, it says, well, this is imposed in lieu of the 1926 tax. So 1932 comes along, and Section 11 says, there is hereby imposed. But again, Section 63, this tax is in lieu of the 1928 Act. In 1934, Section 11, there is hereby imposed. But running over to Section 63, this tax is in lieu of the 1932 tax. 1936, there is hereby imposed in Section 11. Section 63 says this is in lieu of the 1934 tax. And by 1938, Section 11 says there is hereby imposed this tax. And Section 63 says this is in lieu of the 1936 tax. And then when you lift Sections 1 through 62 and stick those in the 1939 code and leave out Section 63 of the 1938 Act, Section 63 didn't go into the 1939 code. Now you've got a continuity, do you not, Peter? The 86... Let me tell you, the 86 code is nothing more than a new name for the 54 code. The 54 code is nothing more than the reorganization, with some changes, but the reorganization of the 1939 code.
Right.
The 1939 code codified the 1938 Income Tax Act.
Okay.
It did not include within it, and the repeal provisions of the 39 code says, well, you know, if it's not in here, it's not repealed. Well, Section 63 of the 1938 Act wasn't stuck into the 39 code, so the 39 code was, in essence, the 1938 Act, and the 38 Act was in lieu of the 36 tax, and the 36 tax was in lieu of the 34 tax, and the 34 tax was in lieu of the 32 tax, and the 32 tax was in lieu of the 28, and 28 was in lieu of the 26, and 26 was in lieu of the 24, and 24 was in lieu of the 21, and 21 was in lieu of 18, and 18 was in lieu of the 1916 and 1917 acts. So there's a continuity here. So that's the reason why I'm saying I just wish people would understand that a little bit. And today, since all the tax acts can be obtained off the net, and they're word searchable, you know, I think people need to, you know, you don't need to deal with, you know, these esoteric other sections of the code. You know, why don't people just study tax imposed? That's real important.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, then, you know, Larkin, you know, one of the things when I saw, you know, of course, Thurston Bell couldn't find much at all. You know, he was just a promoter. You know, but Larkin at least got in and studied the regulations. But, you know, it's real important to realize that starting in 1921, I think, you know, you got this, the regulations that are in effect. You know, in 21, it'd be Regulations 45 amended. And, you know, that's when you have everything that Larkin was talking about in the regulations, you know, unless excluded by the Constitution.
Right.
And, you know, so when you have the ability to look at the tax acts and also the regulations, and all of this is word searchable, gee, you know, it's, you know, I think it's high time for, you know, the people in the tax movement to at least dig into some of this stuff. And let me just tell you, when you do that, you know more about the tax laws than anybody in the government, because the government, IRS, teaches their people from manuals.
Mm-hmm.
You got them on the stand, ask them a question. I get all sorts of wild answers to, you know, well, gee, where's gross income defined? Or, you know, they can't identify Section 6012. They only know manuals.
Mm-hmm.
So here it is. We got a few minutes left, Peter.
Barely. I think that's it, Larry, based on the music. Can you come back next week?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Good enough.
Okay, folks, we'll continue this discussion next week. Again, 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. Be here, and we'll have a fascinating discussion for you. Thanks for tuning in today to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Thank you, Larry. A message.